This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hi there. Just a very quick thank you to everyone who signed up to Patreon following my appeal last week. I've been greatly heartened by the kind messages and how much the podcast means to you. If you enjoy the content, then please sign up for only $4, £3 or €3 a month at coldwarconversations.com/donate. You can cancel at any time. Now, on with today's episode.
You know, it's so important to remember that the war for the Soviets, but also actually for the Americans at the time at Dayton, is still a very real and vivid experience.
This is Cold War Conversations.
There can be no whitewash at the White House.
Do grant a full, free, and absolute pardon unto Richard Nixon.
Welcome to Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Today we speak with Richard Crowder, the author of Détente, The Chance to End the Cold War. Between 1968 and 1975, there was a subtle thawing of relations between East and West, for which Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev coined the name détente. The leaders of the United States and the Soviet Union, Richard Nixon and Leonid Brezhnev, hoped to forge a new relationship between East and West. We talk about some of the key moments, such as where Henry Kissinger, Nixon's Secretary of State, agreed the end to the war in Vietnam. The 1973 Arab-Israeli War, where the world stood on the brink of armed conflict between the Soviet Union and the United States, and the Helsinki Accords, where the agreement to uphold human rights unleashed dissident movements amongst the communist parties of Eastern Europe. Now, I really need your help to allow me the time to continue producing and preserving these Cold War stories. A monthly donation to help keep us on the air is only about $3, £3 or €3 per month. Larger amounts are always welcome. Plus, you can get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a gift for being a monthly financial supporter, and you bask in the warm glow of knowing you are helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. So, back to today's episode. I'm delighted to welcome Richard Crowder to our Cold War conversation.
I've been writing for a few years now in a private capacity, but just so your listeners are aware, obviously, because I'm a working civil servant, I can't comment on current events, but very happy to talk about the book and the détente period.
Well, no, that's fine. So we're going to go back to the late 60s and 1970s for this conversation. And Richard, I think a good point to start on is just to give some context here. Can you just give us a view of what the world looked like in the late 60s, 1970s?
Yes, of course. I mean, I think people who follow your podcast will be very familiar with the context of the Cold War, but it's worth remembering the Cold War came about in the late 1940s. In fact, I wrote about that in my first book, Aftermath. And through the 1950s and early 60s, a period of rising confrontation between the superpowers, build up of nuclear weapons, of course, and both superpowers looking for domination in different spheres. And of course, the Cuban Missile Crisis in the early 1960s was a particular moment of tension when the world came very close to an actual nuclear confrontation. By the late 1960s, the picture begins to shift a bit, and that's why I was interested to look at this period. In terms of military capability on the two sides, the Soviets had invested very heavily in various kinds of nuclear armaments and were approaching parity with the United States. That was very important in strategic terms because it meant that it became increasingly difficult for either side to contemplate the possibility of winning a nuclear exchange because both superpowers had a so-called second strike capability and the ability to retaliate in the event of a nuclear conflict. But with that too, there was a sense that the old politics had not succeeded. And so you had the election of Richard Nixon in the autumn of 1968. Brezhnev had been in power for a few years by that point. He'd taken over in a coup against Khrushchev in 64. But both men feeling that they wanted to explore a different way of carrying forward the relationship between the two countries. And the jargon of the time was talking about a path to peaceful coexistence, if such a thing was possible. The other thing, of course, to mention about the context of this era is it was an incredible time of social and economic change across the world. You had a wave of protests, not just in the United States, of course, against the Vietnam War and race riots, assassination of Martin Luther King and Bob Kennedy and so on, but also in France. You had the Cultural Revolution in China. So a very definite sense of a sort of social and ethical turning point with a new generation that people called the baby boomers coming forward and challenging traditional ways of doing things. So all of this, I think, contributed to this sense that there was a new moment. And I really wanted to focus on it in the book because I think the détente period has perhaps received a bit less attention than some other phases of the Cold War. It hasn't quite got the drama of, the Cuban crisis or the later build-up in the Reagan period. But I thought it was very interesting for other reasons, and that's why I wanted to take a closer look at it.
It is indeed a very fascinating period, and this book could have quite easily been a dry academic piece, but I think you really do bring it alive with the narrative style that you've used. Was there a particular reasoning about that, aside from making it more accessible to a general reader?
Well, thank you. I mean, I think it's for readers to judge whether my particular way of going at it is manages to convey the story. But I guess, a couple of things. I think I was a bit informed by my own sort of working experience. And, you're very conscious that I think it's easy for historians to kind of look back at the sweep of events in foreign policy and, trace the kind of wider dynamics and causes and so on, but perhaps not always convey the way in which for the actual protagonists in the moment, they're struggling to do 101 things under incredible pressure, events piling in one on top of another. And so I wanted to sort of get that sense of, the heat of the moment. And with it, I'm a firm believer that human dynamics and personalities and so on are really crucial to how events work out. I think it's as important not just to talk about the substance, but give a bit of a sense of where they were meeting and even what they were having for dinner, while the conversation was going on or whatever. So you get yourself exactly into that sort of sense of being present in the moment.
Yeah, and I think it's that personal detail because that's a lot of what we're about on this podcast is capturing those personal stories from that person's viewpoint at that time. And there's some very vivid images described in the book, indeed right from the opening scene. And I'd like to just read a couple of sentences from the opening scene. And the book starts in Prague in August 1968, with the Soviet invasion, and the scene is in Alexander Dubček, the Czechoslovak leader's office. And I'll just read you a couple of lines from here. "Comrade Dubček, you are to come with us straight away. It was 9 o'clock on the morning of Wednesday, the 21st of August, 1968. The men spoke in urgent tones. A colonel led the group, short in stature and dressed in Soviet uniform. Two others accompanied him with tweed jackets and open shirts. One spoke Czech. They stood in Alexander Dubček's office in the Central Committee building. Around them, young soldiers formed a circle behind Dubček and his colleagues, guns pointing at their heads. Outside, armoured vehicles had surrounded the building. All the phone lines were cut." So hopefully for the listener, that gives you an indication as to, you know, how vivid the scenes are within this book. And it does work really well, Richard. I really did enjoy this. And I've got another line that I'd like to use later on, which I thought was really strong as well.
Thank you. And I mean, just to illustrate the point I was making about events kind of crowding in on each other, I mean, what interested me about that starting point in August 68 is you've got the, you know, very shocking Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia to suppress the Prague Spring. But you've also got going on in the same week the Democratic Party convention in Chicago that breaks down over scenes of protest against the Vietnam War. And in Moscow, you had the first meeting between Alexander Solzhenitsyn and Andrei Sakharov, who became the two sort of leading lights of the dissident movement inside the Soviet Union. So it right from the start, I wanted to sort of get that sense of sort of things happening together. And I think I really, I was drawn to that moment in 68, because I think it also illustrates what I was saying a moment ago about a sort of sense of things running into a bit of an impasse. From Brezhnev's point of view, I mean, he had been reluctant to go ahead with the invasion of Czechoslovakia. He tried to kind of talk Dubček round, but it, you know, just hadn't been possible. And he had to ultimately had to sort of fall in line with hardliners within the Politburo and take that step. But having taken it, I think the Soviets were very conscious that, you know, they potentially faced a backlash inside the Eastern Bloc, and that their position was perhaps a bit more vulnerable than it might have seemed from a distance. And meanwhile, in Washington, you know, the first reaction, this at the sort of tail end of the Johnson presidency, was a feeling of frustration, and they realized there was nothing they could do to change the course of events in Czechoslovakia.
Yes. Start of the book, you outline 11 key moments of détente.
I mean, the book picks it up in 68, as I say, with the invasion of Czechoslovakia, and I carry the story through to 75, when you had the American withdrawal from Vietnam and the Helsinki Accords and so on. Although détente carries on in a sort of a rather muted form into the Carter presidency in the later 1970s. I mean, that period between 68 and 75, I think you can trace a kind of an overall flow of events. Nixon comes into the presidency, winning quite a narrow election in the end in November 68. And he comes in with a reputation as from the Republican right, tough on communism, but willing to talk to the Soviets and see if it's possible to make progress on the different areas. And of course, Vietnam, top of the list, trying to find the right sort of dignified way for America to exit and have peace with honor in Vietnam. But also you had arms control talks, which had some initiatives that started under Johnson, but then that gets going in 69-70. You've got the status of Berlin as a divided city with the wartime allies as the occupying powers, and the situation in the Middle East following the Six-Day War in 1967. So you've got these various strands, but for the first couple of years, Nixon and his national security advisor, Henry Kissinger, really kind of struggle to get traction. And then the turning point comes in 1971, when they begin to make some headway with Moscow, that they make a first statement on the scope for an arms control agreement, but also they get a break with China. America has been putting out feelers towards the Chinese for a few years, but then the message comes back that the Chinese are willing to accept Kissinger as an emissary to Beijing and to pave the way for Nixon to make a visit himself. And then that all happens in 72, so you get Nixon's visit to Beijing, and then followed a few months later by a summit in Moscow with Brezhnev, first big summit meeting between the two leaders, and the agreements on SALT, strategic arms limitation talks, and anti-ballistic missile defense, and so on. And then followed towards the end of that year, it's a difficult process, but in January 1973, agreement on a peace deal in Vietnam. So at that point, I think really détente is sort of looking good, and you know, Nixon can point to significant achievements. But then the period 73, 74, 75, you see the initiative flounder. Some of that's down to Nixon's own situation with the Watergate scandal, but also the Yom Kippur War in the Middle East and the subsequent oil crisis, which sort of turns the tables. Suddenly the Soviet Union gets a bonanza from higher oil prices, and the Western economies are very hard hit. And you have a mounting pressure from the dissidents inside the Soviet Union, which is picked up by hawks in the US, and then Ronald Reagan as a presidential contender, who argue that that a policy of seeking accommodation with the Soviet Union is mistaken, and that America should return back to a tougher line. So that's really the sort of the overall ebb and flow of the détente period.
Right. Well, let's just dig into one of those, and we could start off with Kissinger's secret mission to China. Can you just give us a bit more detail on that?
Yes. So that takes place in July 1971. As I say, Nixon and Kissinger get a secret message from the Chinese. It's passed through the Pakistanis, who are acting as an intermediary. Curiously enough, I talk about events sort of piling in on each other. The message turns up in a beautifully sort of little handwritten note just after Kissinger comes out of a particularly tricky meeting with Anatoly Dobrynin, who is the Soviet ambassador in Washington and his main counterpart for the sort of the secret channel between the two superpowers. So it's one of those moments where, you know, you step from one situation straight into another. Anyway, Nixon and Kissinger immediately see the potential. They want to reach out to the Chinese. Of course, the backdrop is there's been the Sino-Soviet split through the 1960s. So China is already kind of splintering away from the Soviet bloc. And the Americans want to reach out to China with the potential to change what has been 25 years, basically, of a frozen relationship between communist China and America following the communist takeover at the end of the 1940s. So Kissinger goes off on a secret trip to Beijing. He has to concoct a cover story, which involves travel through South Asia. He has to pretend that he's fallen ill with a tummy bug in Pakistan. Having just served there myself, I know that that's a frequent occupational hazard.
Yeah, and I think what's quite ironic is he does actually get a tummy bug as well, doesn't he?
Well, he does in India, yes. So he has to suffer in silence and then fly on to Beijing. Anyway, so it goes to Beijing, a 48-hour trip, and with Zhou Enlai, the Chinese premier, he thrashes out an initial statement between the two sides, signalling the visit and dancing around the issue of Taiwan, because of course Taiwan is under a nationalist government who'd been on the opposite side in the civil war in China before the communist takeover, and the United States still recognizes Taiwan in terms of diplomatic relations. So there's a delicate point there, but essentially it's a bit of a sort of boy's own adventure for Kissinger. You know, he describes flying over the Hindu Kush, looking down on K2, the mountain, and you know this incredible experience of top secret diplomacy.
Again, some great imagery there. Now, Was part of this rapprochement with China in order to put more pressure on the Soviets? Was that part of the game as well?
Well, so Nixon and Kissinger are very careful in their public statements to say that their action is not directed at any third party. And Nixon makes that clear in the televised statement he delivers when Kissinger comes back from this trip. But of course, in private, they recognize that absolutely this has given them leverage. Their whole, I should have said that their whole sort of diplomatic game plan is to draw linkages between these different issues, Germany and the Middle East and arms control and so on, and to use that to create trade-offs and linkages. And the prospect that America is drawing China into its orbit, of course, create high nervousness in Moscow. We know that from various people's memoirs. And when Kissinger next meets Dobrynin, the Soviet ambassador in Washington, it's a different story. You know, Dobrynin is clearly keen to talk and you know, more forward leaning on the various dossiers. So undoubtedly they're able to use this to create a bit of a turning point.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more. The next area that you cover is the Berlin Four Power Agreement. Now, I think some people might think that, you know, Berlin, its status was relatively set in stone at Potsdam in 1945. But obviously there's the building of the Berlin Wall in 1961. So why do they need a further agreement in place?
Well, of course, there was no formal peace treaty with Germany at the end of the war. The victorious Allies tried to agree on one, and they couldn't. So they ended up partitioning Germany with the occupation zones in East and West. And that turned into two separate Germanys, West Germany under the sort of the orbit of the United States and NATO, and East Germany with the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact. It was possible to reach peace agreements on Austria and other countries, but Germany was just too large and too problematic. And as you alluded to, within that, Berlin is the most complicated element, because Berlin is inside East Germany, about 100 miles away from West Germany, but it is itself divided into four occupation zones with the British, the French, the Americans, and the Soviets. And it's become a flashpoint through the 1950s and 60s. In 1961, the East Germans were obliged to construct the Berlin Wall to prevent their citizens from seeking asylum in West Berlin. And the concern continued into the 1970s that Berlin could become a further source of tension. Coupled with that, you have a very interesting context with Willy Brandt, the West German Chancellor, who was also elected as a Social Democrat in 1968, around the same time as Nixon, and who embarks on his own form of détente with so-called Ostpolitik, reaching out to the Soviet Union and other Eastern European countries, seeking to apologize for the Nazi past, but also raising the prospect of recognition of West Germany and East Germany, but in return for recognition of borders around post-war Europe. But Brandt cannot make progress on the agreements that he initials with Moscow and other Eastern European capitals until there is parallel agreement on Berlin, and that can only be made by the four controlling occupying powers. So you get this very interesting sort of knot within a knot of diplomatic issues, and Kissinger seizes on this. And is very careful with Kenneth Rush, who's the American ambassador in Germany and the point man in the negotiations over Berlin, to pace those negotiations so they can work alongside linkages with arms control and Vietnam and elsewhere.
I've noticed that you use this word linkages quite a lot, and I'm presuming this is common diplomatic parlance for sort of trading off one thing against another and linking them together. Is that what you're describing there?
Well, exactly, and not just in diplomacy. I mean, I think any form of negotiation with sort of multiple issues gets into that kind of dynamic. But I think it is fair to say that it's something of a hallmark of the Nixon-Kissinger approach. And part of my interest in this era was this is diplomatic tradecraft at the highest level. You might argue there were moral questions about some of the things that they got involved in, but you can't underplay their skill and cunning in pursuing it.
Yeah, and I think it's indicated in that four-power agreement, because I was surprised to find out that Berlin, the word Berlin, doesn't appear in any of the text. It's only defined as the relevant area or something like that, which sort of indicates the sort of dance that they had to do.
They had to get into all sorts of complicated ways not to imply recognition in one direction or another, but to resolve all the practical issues about, how are you going to have a railway corridor and a sort of a motorway corridor to between West Berlin and West Germany and the rest of it.
Yeah. Now, Nixon's visit to China in February 1972 was pretty earth-shattering, I guess, because obviously there was, the Korean War, where effectively the US, albeit under the aegis of the United Nations, was directly at war with Chinese forces. And this must have been a huge surprise to people who weren't in the know at the time.
Exactly. I mean, I think Nixon was able to do this because he came from the Republican right. So he had a reputation as being tough on communism. One of the famous moments of his vice presidency serving under Eisenhower was when he had the so-called kitchen debate with Khrushchev at an exhibition in Moscow, and argued that the capitalist system was superior to the communist one. So remarkably, he is able to command a degree of support within the Republican Party and even bipartisan in Washington, despite doing something which, as you say, was quite controversial, and which for the two decades before that, it had been very difficult for any American president to look soft on communist China. The visit itself is as much about the image as the substance. And I think this is a important point to remember about this era, that you have the television has become widespread in American homes. You get the beginnings of satellite broadcasting and so on. So carrying the news story becomes as important as the substance behind closed doors. And Nixon and his advance party, led by Alexander Haig, who at that time is deputy to Kissinger, map out a day-by-day program with these different incredible photo opportunities, landing at the airport and then going up to the Great Wall and watching a ballet and banquet in the Great Hall of the People and so on. But of course, behind the scenes, he has a meeting with Mao, who's pretty old and doddery by this stage, but still it's significant that the two men get to meet. And extensive talks with Zhou Enlai and his team, although the Americans at this point are still sticking to their position over Taiwan. Of course, by the end of the 1970s, that changes and America goes for full diplomatic recognition of communist China. But for this first visit, they hold firm on that position.
Right. And then following that a few months later, there's a summit in Moscow. Is that to sort of make sure that the Soviets still feel loved in some way?
Well, it's always been the objective of détente to be able to get to a meeting at the highest level. Brezhnev is I think partly drawn to it as much for the sort of the drama and the showmanship as the substance. Nixon feels that his position is secure. China visit's gone well. He's been able to face down an offensive by the North Vietnamese in the run-up to the Moscow summit, and he orders the aerial mining of Hanoi Harbour to prevent shipments of Soviet arms supplies to the North Vietnamese. So he feels he can go to Moscow from a position of strength. And behind the scenes, the two sides have been working up agreements in lots of different areas on sort of cooperation, including actually there's an agreement on cooperation in space exploration, which leads a few years later to the link up between Apollo and Soyuz missions. But crucially, they're able to sign agreements on ABM, anti-ballistic missile defense, which limits both sides in how far they can deploy defensive missile systems, and on strategic arms limitation, which sets limits on the long-range nuclear arsenal that the two countries, two superpowers, are able to possess. And of course, behind that, there then has to be a whole system of oversight and verification and so on, which means it's really the first significant step in a series of arms negotiations that then run on through the remainder of the Cold War.
Right. So this is the SALT treaties, the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaties.
That's right. Yeah.
Right. Right. And how does Nixon get on with Brezhnev? Do they sort of see eye to – well, not see eye to eye, but is there any form of chemistry between them, would you say?
Well, I think there is. I said that Brezhnev's a bit of a showman. You know, it's worth remembering with Brezhnev that our image of him, I think, is of the man in his final years, standing on top of Lenin's tomb in May Day parades, and you know, very poor health by the end of his tenure. But at this time, Brezhnev is in reasonably good shape, and he's energetic and passionate. He's very good at charming people, and Nixon sort of sees in him, I think, a kindred political spirit. He talks in his memoirs about Brezhnev being like a sort of a trade union boss or a sort of big city mayor in the United States. So Nixon kind of immediately is able to recognize the type. And at their very first meeting in Brezhnev's office in the Kremlin, Nixon does the trick of shooing his own interpreter out of the room and operating through the Soviet interpreter, Viktor Sokhodrov. So, it's a sort of a basic kind of confidence-building measure. And then we see them again meeting in 1973 when Brezhnev comes over to Washington, and they go on to California and stay at Nixon's Casa Pacifica, his house on the West Coast, and they have a final summit in 1974. Although by that time, détente is really running its course, and Nixon's mired in Watergate.
Yeah, I've seen I think there's a great photo of the two of them on a bench somewhere chatting away, and it looks like they are getting on like a house on fire.
Yes, I think that's they go down to the Crimea, right. where Brezhnev has his seaside property. So that's in 1974 that they do the Crimea trip.
Yeah, somewhat unlikely pairing, but as you say, they could see a bit of each other in themselves. I want to highlight our friends at the Cold War channel on YouTube. I've been watching their quality videos for some time, and I highly recommend them. The videos are presented in an easily digestible format and cover some fascinating and sometimes little-known Cold War subjects. From the Kyshtym disaster, the biggest nuclear disaster before Chernobyl, to the anti-Soviet guerrilla war in the Baltics. The episodes on Cold War TV provide a fantastic insight into areas of the Cold War not covered elsewhere. Just search for Cold War TV on YouTube. And now, back to our episode. In the course of this period, the Paris Peace Accords are signed, which allow the US to exit Vietnam. But it doesn't really go to plan, does it? Because the idea was that South Vietnam would still exist as a state.
Yes. So the final years of the Vietnam War are a complicated period, and it's important to distinguish between what happens in late 72 and early 73, which, as you say, leads to the Paris Peace Accords, and then the final collapse of South Vietnam that comes in April 1975. So in 1972-73, Kissinger's been pursuing secret negotiations with the North Vietnamese for some time, but the North Vietnamese think that they have the upper hand. They think that the Americans are running out of patience in Vietnam, and that domestic pressure through protests and so on means that they'll be forced into withdrawal. And really, the challenge for Nixon and Kissinger is to pursue what they call Vietnamization, which means substituting South Vietnamese troops for American troops in the actual war fighting. But to keep up sufficient pressure on the North Vietnamese, including through the air war, that the North Vietnamese are ultimately forced into a peace deal. And by the autumn of 1972, Kissinger talks in Paris, believes that he's got there, and he comes back. This is on the shortly before the election in November 1972. He comes back to Washington, but then it becomes clear that the South Vietnamese cannot sign up to the deal that he's reached with the North Vietnamese, which would include a power sharing agreement for the government in the South, and so the deal starts to unravel. And Kissinger's forced to give a press conference in the White House, where he tries to park the deal until after the election with the famous line, "Peace is at hand." Then fast forward to the December period of 72, North Vietnamese are refusing to deal, even though Nixon's been re-elected with a landslide. And so Nixon and Kissinger sanction the so-called Christmas bombing of Hanoi, a devastating period of aerial bombardment, widespread protest inside the US and elsewhere. But it does force the North Vietnamese back to the negotiating table. And the result is the peace accords in January 73, which provide for a ceasefire between North and South, so say a power-sharing agreement, and the return, crucially, of prisoners of war, American prisoners of war who've been held in North Vietnam. But at that point, you might have thought that the agreement, particularly when backed up with the potential threat of US force, might hold. But over the next couple of years, it unravels. Obviously, Nixon's demise over Watergate is crucial. And Congress, where there's been a strong anti-Vietnam lobby for many years, imposes more and more legislative restrictions on how much military assistance the administration is able to give to the South Vietnamese. So it reaches a point where in early 75, the North Vietnamese realize, by this time Nixon's had to resign over Watergate, and they realize that they can go back in, launch an offensive to capture Saigon. The South Vietnamese topple pretty quickly, and Gerry Ford, who's taken over as president after Nixon, is forced to carry out the rather ignominious American evacuation operation, which the famous images of helicopters pulling out of Saigon and so on.
Yeah, there's some great photos in the book as well. I think one of the ones that I did find particularly fascinating was Nixon talking with some peace protesters or anti-Vietnam War protesters at the Lincoln Memorial.
That's right. So that was from 1970, right in the period when Nixon is under the heaviest domestic pressure over the Vietnam War. And crucially, in the spring of 1970, he sanctions a incursion into Cambodia to take down bases of the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese, which are just across the border from South Vietnam in Cambodia. But there's a very big backlash in American domestic opinion, and particularly, as you say, from peace protesters, students, Vietnam veterans, and protesters come flocking to Washington. There's an awful episode at Kent State University when the local National Guard open fire on protesters and a number of students are killed. And in the kind of very intense days after that incident, Nixon makes this rather bizarre early morning trip out to the Lincoln Memorial. He grabs his valet, who's a Mexican-American, and his Secret Service bodyguards, and rushes off to the Lincoln Memorial and has this conversation as the sun's coming up first thing in the morning with a group of peace protesters.
Yeah. So following the peace accords, there's a further summit, this time in Washington. Is anything achieved at that one?
So the Washington summit indeed comes in June 1973. Dayton's getting a bit thinner by this stage. So, I mean, basically, you have a sequence of three summits, Moscow 72, Washington 73, Moscow again 74. But on each occasion, there's a sort of more limited menu of actual agreements that that the two sides can strike. However, it is notable for, as you say, the chemistry between Brezhnev and Nixon. And Nixon takes Brezhnev over to the West Coast to his house at Casa Pacifica. He gives him a poolside party with various Hollywood celebrities. Kissinger turns up with the Bond girl of the time, Jill St. Clair, and Ronald Reagan turns up as well. And then that evening, very late at night, but Brezhnev's got kind of confused with the time difference and still wide awake. They sit down in Nixon's study in his house, and Brezhnev warns Nixon that trouble is brewing in the Middle East, and suggests that the superpowers need to reach some sort of understanding between them. Nixon, joined by Kissinger, pushes back and says, you know, we stand by Israel, we're not going to talk about this. And Kissinger's furious that they've been ambushed on an issue which wasn't on the agenda and late at night. But obviously the Yom Kippur War follows only, four or five months later. And it turns out that indeed there is trouble brewing in the Middle East.
I think the Yom Kippur was quite an interesting one because outwardly it looks like it's a three-way war between Egypt, Syria, and Israel. But the Soviets are seriously considering armed intervention in that as well. And the Americans have to ratchet up their military presence in the area, don't they?
Well, that's right. I mean, it's perhaps worth just reminding ourselves of the context of the Arab Israeli wars through the Cold War period. So, of course, Israel created in 1948, and then a series of wars in 56, 67, and then indeed in 73. And in 56 and 67, the Israelis have really achieved remarkable military dominance over their Arab neighbours, and secured control over the Sinai Peninsula and the Golan Heights in Syria and so on. But then in 1973, Egypt and Syria strike back. They prepare a surprise offensive on a holy day in Israel, Yom Kippur, and have been preparing secretly for many months. And the objective, particularly of President Sadat in Egypt, is not perhaps so much to crush Israel, but to show that the Arab countries are able to threaten Israel militarily. And so it proves. The Israeli armed forces are thrown back in the early days of the conflict. And at one point, it looks as though Israel is at risk of defeat. But then the Americans stage a huge airlift of military equipment, larger in scale even than the Berlin airlift, and the Israelis managed to turn the tide. Situation at the time of a ceasefire is that you end up with an Israeli counteroffensive, which has gone back over the Suez Canal into deep into Egypt. So you have quite a volatile situation, including with Egyptian forces encircled on the east bank of the Suez Canal. The situation quickly turns into a confrontation between the superpowers. Americans have been backing the Israelis, Soviets, of course, Egypt and Syria. And indeed, at one point, when the Soviets fear that the Israelis may be about to push things even further in Egypt, they start to put paratroops on alert to be sent into the theater. All this is playing out alongside one of the crucial moments of the Watergate affair, with the so-called Saturday Night Massacre, when Nixon sacks his own attorney general, of course. So Kissinger is leading the discussions in the National Security Council, and a crucial stage, he puts American troops on DEFCON 3 alert, which, as your readers will know, is a very high level of readiness for U.S. forces, and was used on only a few occasions through the Cold War. So for a few hours, you have a very serious looming confrontation between the superpowers.
Right, yeah, no, a very dangerous time during the Cold War, and probably and one that's not necessarily recognized as a dangerous time. You know, things like the Cuban Missile Crisis and the Able Archer exercise in 1983 has been another point at which there could have been an accidental release of nuclear weapons. But that period of the Yom Kippur, the 1973 Arab-Israeli War, is less well known. Worth exploring further, I think, in a future episode, but not today. So, Richard, in 1974, Nixon resigns from office because of evidence found around his knowledge that the Democrats' offices were bugged in the Watergate building.
Yes. So the Watergate affair, of course, is extremely complex, and you know, evoked huge controversy at the time. Obviously, the context, as you say, was a break-in by operatives in June 72 into the Democrat Party headquarters. That was ahead of the election that autumn. The issue for Nixon is really that he sanctions a cover-up, and then the cover-up becomes a cover-up of a cover-up, and so on. So he instructs Bob Haldeman and John Ehrlichman, his two closest aides, to talk to Helms, in charge of the CIA, and Vernon Walters, his deputy, and get the CIA to lean on the FBI to back off on the investigation in the immediate aftermath of the incident. All of that is unknown for many months, and the White House do a pretty effective job of keeping people quiet, paying people money, and the rest of it. So Watergate isn't really an issue in the 72 election, which Nixon wins by a landslide against George McGovern, his Democratic opponent. But then through early mid-73, more starts to come out. People start to talk. Congress gets interested. So you have the appointment of a special prosecutor to look into the case. That's on the sort of the legal side. But also you have Congress beginning to explore scope for impeachment hearings. Through into 74, Nixon's support is really draining away. A crucial moment comes, as I was alluding to, in October 73, at the same time as the Yom Kippur War, when he has to sack his own legal team, and opinion polls start to move very sharply against him. So he's losing support in the country, and that flows through to losing support in Congress. And really, the end game comes in July, August 74, by which time he's only down to a handful of senators prepared to back him. And in fact, there is no impeachment hearing in the end. Nixon sees the writing on the wall and resigns without being formally impeached. And he remains the only US president to have resigned from office.
Yes. Yeah, so his vice president, Gerald Ford, becomes president, and he goes to the final summit of the détente period.
Yes, so Gerald Ford takes over, having himself been appointed from being minority leader to being vice president in October 73, when Spiro Agnew, the previous vice president, has to resign over a different scandal. Ford offers a healing presidency, as he puts it. Watergate has been a huge national trauma, and Ford wants to try and reunite the nation. But he's saddled with the question about what to do with Nixon, whether the legal proceedings against Nixon should be allowed to proceed or not, what to do about the Nixon's papers, including the infamous White House tapes and so on. So he can't really shake off the shadow of Nixon. But nonetheless, he presses ahead with contact with the Soviets and goes to Vladivostok at the end of 1974. He was due to travel to Japan and South Korea anyway, but it's not much further to go to Vladivostok, so they fix up a summit there. It's not a very significant meeting. There is a more discussion on interim terms on further arms control to run through the 70s, but it's not a particularly substantive encounter. They hold it in the rather strange setting of a Soviet air base in deep winter, surrounded by snow. And of course, it also marks the point at which Brezhnev's health begins to deteriorate significantly. So he suffers a stroke immediately after the summit, and is dogged by ill health for the remainder of his time in office.
Yeah, there's some great photos of both Brezhnev and Ford with very large coats, which obviously they would have needed in deep winter at a Soviet air base. And I think Brezhnev takes a shine to Ford's coat, doesn't he?
Yes, that's right. So Ford has picked up a wolfskin coat from Alaska, where they've done a stopover during this this trip, and he wears it for the summit. But he can see that Brezhnev has taken rather a fancy to it, and so in the sort of the bonhomie of the final parting handshakes, he hands over his coat to Brezhnev.
Yeah, great imagery there, and the sort of last point that you have around détente is the Helsinki Accords in July 75.
Yes, so I mean, again, I think like much of this period, Helsinki has been a bit sort of overlooked in the wider sweep of the Cold War, and I think it's worth reminding ourselves of what happened there. So this was a sort of offshoot of both détente and Ostpolitik, that the Soviets had been keen to see some kind of final settlement of post-war borders in Europe, where obviously because of the lack of a peace agreement around Germany, you still had provisional borders between Germany and Poland and in other places. And through 73, 74, and then into 75, this turns into a big multilateral negotiation between the NATO countries and the Warsaw Pact countries, and about various buckets of issues. So one of them indeed being post-war borders, one being conventional forces, which eventually turns into the conventional forces in Europe agreements, and one about other issues, including environmental and human rights. And I think, you know, what is important to remember about the Helsinki agreements, which are concluded with a signing ceremony In the Finnish capital, which all the leaders of these countries go to. So it's a marathon of diplomatic speeches with everybody getting up in turn to congratulate themselves on the achievement. But it does provide for the beginnings of civil society groups on both sides of the Iron Curtain. And of course, for the dissidents inside the Soviet Union, and also, people like Solidarity in Poland and Charter 77 in Czechoslovakia, and so on, this is a very important signal that they are able to point to an international commitment that the Eastern European states have made to allow such groups to exist. So the consequences, of course, are significant as you move into the 1980s and the various ways in which the communist system comes under internal pressure in Eastern Europe.
Now, you know, the book has, as we sort of said at the start, has some great pictures painted in the text, and I think, you know, one of the other ones that I really liked was one with Kissinger, who looms as a huge character across the book, and obviously should do because of his role during this period. But there's a line at the end of one of the chapters where, and this is, I think, is from the Neil Ferguson biography of Kissinger, but the line is: Kissinger looked at his conversation partner. His speech had become more halting, gentle. Brezhnev was an old man in search of peace.
I mean, I think it's worth remembering that both Brezhnev and Nixon are complex, multi-layered characters. So, you see different sides of them at different moments and in different circumstances. The episode that you're alluding to was when Kissinger goes over to Moscow in the run up to the 73 summit, and he's taken on a hunting trip by Brezhnev. They're shooting wild boar. The wild boar are enticed to come within a sort of only a few feet of the hunter's hide, so that Brezhnev's able to get a clear shot, and Kissinger doesn't really enjoy it. It's not his thing, but he sort of plays along, and they fall into this conversation, and Brezhnev reminisces about his wartime experience and so on, and I think, you know, it's so important to remember that the war for the Soviets, but also actually for the Americans at the time at Dayton, is still a very real and vivid experience. So Brezhnev had been a senior political commander at the front. He'd seen the liberation of Ukraine after Nazi occupation, and then the advance through into Europe. Nixon had served in the U.S. Navy at an outpost in the Pacific. And of course, Kissinger, remarkably, grew up inside Nazi Germany with a Jewish family who managed to get out before the persecution of the Jews really took hold, and fled as refugees to the United States, and then subsequently during the war joined the American army and went back to Germany, serving in the occupation force straight after the war, and you know, many of the other protagonists in the book also had formative war experiences. So I think it's important to remember that, you know, when they talk about war and talk about wanting to avoid nuclear confrontation and so on, it has a very real and a very personal meaning.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point to make, and one that's not necessarily always remembered. When you were writing the book, did you speak to any of these people firsthand?
I didn't. No, it's a great period to cover, because there really is a wealth of material from the, you know, different documents published, and obviously incredible material with the White House tapes and so on, and I used a lot of the oral histories, which were recorded in the 90s and 2000s. But the relatively few people are still around, and they are quite advanced in age now. But of course, Kissinger still has a lot.
Yeah, I was amazed to see that he was still alive, and obviously Carter is still around as well. You've been listening to Richard Crowder, the author of Détente, The Chance to End the Cold War. Now, lucky listeners, we're doing another Cold War Conversations book giveaway, so make sure you listen through to the end of this episode, and there will be details as to how to enter that giveaway in the show notes.
Ian, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
And we have further information such as videos and links in our show notes, which will show as a link in your podcast app. Now, you wouldn't be listening to this podcast without the generous support of our patrons. However, I want to especially thank our Politburo level members who are contributing a generous $30 a month to keep us on the air. These are Tony Sowoods, Sam Hardwick, Nicholas Butter, Frederick Esposito, Jeffrey Jones, and Peter Ryan. Don't forget, if you like one of those Cold War Conversations coasters and help support the show, then head over to coldwarconversations.com/donate. If you can't wait for the next episode, please visit our Facebook discussion group where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.